When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Hello, guys. Welcome to Finding Annie. I am reporting live from the rave shed at the end of the garden on a very sunny, beautiful Thursday morning. Just had a jog, so I'm high on endorphins. And I'm buzzing from this podcast and all the reactions we're getting from it. Thank you to everyone listening and getting in touch about it. Let's start by going backwards to the Sharon Horgan episode last week, the Fame Game. I asked you guys to send me some fun encounters you've had with celebrities off the back of last week's Fame theme. Shout out to Lily, who told me about having to sit in an airport security room with Paul Weller while she got her bag checked, and a kind of strange encounter where Paul Weller ended up helping her pack her bag and like wrapping her GHD wires around her GHDs and like zipping her toiletries into her bag, and how she'll never forget how surreal that was. And then also shout outs to Matthew Broadbent, who talked about losing his Sonar Festival ticket in Barcelona and like being absolutely heartbroken and sitting on the phone in a kind of cafe crying to his friend about how he wasn't going to be able to get back into Sonar Festival. But he happened to be sitting beside Terry Hall, the lead singer of The Specials, and Terry Hall gave him his tickets, his two AAA tickets to Sonar that he had finished with. And then this guy Matthew had the weekend of his life. So yeah, two amazing anecdotes there. Thank you to Lily and thank you to Matthew. This week, the episode is all about the divine feminine. I want to start by saying, if you are moved to contact me about anything that you hear in this episode, please do. The email is findingannymac@gmail.com. And it's a big theme. So let's start it with a memory from my old friend Shauna, who I was lucky enough to live with when I went to Queen's University in Belfast. Shauna is from Derry, as you will hear from her fantastic accent. Take it away, Shauna.
Annie, at university, God, how long ago was that now? Oh my God, it's like, what age are we now? When was that? That's like, oh God, that's like 21 years ago. We all lived in a big old house together in Belfast, six girls, for a year. And then one of the girls moved out and one of our friends moved in, a boy, the only boy. We weren't very girly girls. Annie, you in particular, probably, really grungy. All Saints were all in then, and we all had our kind of combats and vest tops and tank tops and trainers. I think in a house of six girls, we didn't possess a pair of high heels between us. So it was, there was no straighteners or HD things going on in our house anyway. It was all very grungy, and I think, Annie, you kind of did that best, in fairness, that grungy thing. Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And then we got, our first guy come into the house then, didn't he? One of the girls went away to France, and in came our friend, and he was the only boy. And I remember you borrowed all his clothes because you liked his kind of combat-y look. And that was fun. But yeah, you liked hanging around with the guys more and playing poker and that, whereas the rest of us were just away the library or whatever, being geeks. But I think you enjoyed your late nights listening to Van Morrison and doing your poker with all the lads.
Thank you to Shauna, my friend from Belfast. Well, she's actually from Derry, as you can tell by the incredible accent. But we live together in Belfast, so thank you to her for reminding me of those poker nights in Belfast with my friends, and also of me stealing my friend Malachi's baggy clothes. I then moved from Belfast to Farnborough and did a master's for a year, where I moved in with five guys and continued the poker thing lots of late nights playing poker in a smoky haze. I've always been friends with guys. It's always come very easy to me to do that. I have two brothers. When I was growing up in our housing estate, I always used to be the girl down the green, playing football with the guys, climbing trees with the guys, all of that stuff. So yeah, it was pretty natural for me to become a DJ when I started out. I didn't really feel any imposter syndrome for being a lone girl in a world dominated by guys. It felt quite natural for me. I'm kind of grateful to my parents for letting me just be who I wanted to be and letting me kind of have the freedom to figure out who I was and not kind of getting in the way or trying to condition me in any way when it came to that kind of stuff. I had no dolls. I was really into Sylvanian families, but yeah, not into Barbies or anything like that. And I came really late to everything woman related, you know, periods, that came quite late, grooming, glam, manicures, eyebrow shaping, all of that stuff happened much later in my life, kind of late 20s, early 30s. So yeah, the word feminine and me, I've kind of got a funny relationship with it. And I thought it would be a good thing to explore for this episode. So I've called the episode The Divine Feminine. And it's about what it is to feel feminine and people's different interpretations of it. So femininity obviously can be attributed to any gender. You know, it doesn't have to, you know, it's not exclusively a woman thing. You know, a man can be feminine too. But it's still a challenging word in this day and age when the traditional binary nature of gender is feeling more and more out of date. I was doing a bit of research and I found this girl, Kaya Day, who last year actually wrote to thesaurus.com, which is one of my most used and most loved websites, FYI, to complain about her findings when she looked up masculine and feminine. So when she looked up masculine on the thesaurus, she got loads of words, a massive list of words, including words such as macho, manly, beefcake, gallant, hardy, robust, strapping. And for feminine, it was about a quarter of the number of words. And it was words like ladylike, dainty, soft, tender, womanish. She described her findings as almost comical and then sent a list of words to thesaurus.com that she thought could work. So words like compassionate, intuitive, maternal, sensual, empathetic, etc. Equally, I'm sure the lads out there would really appreciate some more nuances in the descriptions of masculinity, like beefcake and hardy is a little narrow. I think it's fascinating. Like this, I feel like we could do a whole podcast series on the issue of gender, and I think maybe we'll do some more with this. But I'm becoming more and more fascinated by it, especially as I said, as you know, just these kind of traditional binary rules are kind of disintegrating in front of our eyes. And I can imagine just so many people panicking and being scared of this, like people are scared of change, you know. You know, people who love religion, it's this idea of the comfort of fixed boundaries and fixed rules and fixed boxes to fit in. When those start going away, people lose their sense of self. And that's why it's so brilliant seeing a kind of new generation of kids being really comfortable with not being fit into boxes when it comes to gender. For me, when I think of being a woman and the kind of attributes of a woman and femininity, I just think strength. Like, I think women are inherently strong. And where is that in the definition of femininity? I do think, even though our roles are evolving so rapidly, the boundaries for how women and men can present themselves in society are still just too narrow. They need to change quicker. And people need to be able to feel out their way of who they are with no feelings of shame, no feelings of self-doubt. And this starts when we're kids. My interviewee today is Amanda Lepore. So she is a transgender singer, performance artist and model, and someone who was self-proclaimed to be born in the wrong body. She has, from when she was a child, been fixated with the feminine form and has spent her life achieving this for herself through extensive plastic surgery and just total dedication to the aesthetic of the classic Hollywood starlets, Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield specifically. Her body has kind of become her livelihood over the years, specifically when she met the legendary photographer David LaChapelle and became his muse and his feature of some of his most iconic works over the years. She was one of the infamous New York club kids. This was a kind of group of kids who were outrageous in their costumes. They were mad, flamboyant kids, and they became really known in the New York nightclub scene and kind of took over venues and were just this really exciting group of kind of total kind of freak kids who embraced their differences and kind of made a thing out of them. They were discovered by a guy called Michael Alig. He was the kind of leader of the crew. And there's an iconic YouTube interview where there are guests on the Joan Rivers show. And Michael was eventually arrested for murdering his roommate and a fellow club kid. And that inspired a feature film starring Macaulay Culkin called Party Monster, which is proper iconic now. Amanda has had the most colourful and mad life. And she actually lives in a hotel called Hotel 17, which is where loads of the club kids lived in back in the days. Hotel 17 is in the East Village in Manhattan. And that is where she invited me to meet her and to interview her. Her house is basically this tiny hotel room. The sofa is also her bed. When you go in, it's quite kind of overwhelming when you kind of get your bearings, and it's quite a small space, but it's really cozy and every single kind of, you know, inch is accounted for. The room is rammed from floor to ceiling with shoes and with clothes, and it's just full of character. Amanda never left the club since she started going in the late 80s, and she's been making appearances in New York City and around the world as a dancer and a singer ever since. So that's kind of her working job. She dances and she sings in clubs. So I wanted to get to know her, and most of all, I think I wanted to try and understand the psychology of why she had taken her body to such extremes, why she was so fixated with this feminine ideal. It all became clear at the very end of the conversation, and I could not stop thinking about it for ages after. But back to the night in question. When I met her, she had a show later on that night and she was getting ready for her night. So she was showing me this incredibly intricate outfit with like suspenders and pants, a kind of brassiere, all embroidered with these beautiful kind of hearts and diamantes that she'd done herself. She makes all the outfits herself. She's so dedicated to her looks. So yeah, let's see what happened. Enter the podcast, Amanda Lepore. Well, thank you for having me in your room, Amanda.
You're welcome. You're
it's
welcome.
Such a pleasure
thank
to
you
meet you.
Thank you for keeping it convenient for me.
Oh, such a pleasure. You've just shown me through. I'm just trying to think of how many parts there were to that outfit you just showed me. Was like six? The pants?
At least.
Yeah. That you have hand adorned mm-hmm. with roses, with hearts. And this is for one of your shows.
Yes.
How many shows do you do a week at the moment? How much are you working?
I do like one show a week at Borchland Follies at the mm-hmm. McKendrick Hotel. And then I also go away and then do shows. And okay. I also sing too, but on Friday here, I do sing there too. Like I'll do one song and do a burlesque number.
So yeah, what happens when you do the shows? For people who haven't seen you do the show, what goes on?
I usually do champagne, that song Champagne, and then I'll do like a strip tease and then get down to the underwear, but very glamorous. Mm-hmm. And I'll take like a Louboutin lipstick that's really large and jewel it to match the outfits, and it's in my pussy.
Yeah.
And I could keep it like in there, like, you know, like with the muscle. Like.
Yeah.
So like I
did. Did you have to learn how to do that? I can imagine that's pretty hard.
No, I was just bored one night and I did it with another lipstick, and then like I just did it, was part of the striptease and everything. Yeah. And then I got into it like more, and then tried to like get like a bigger one. And
yeah,
I tried to do it with like a bigger one that was that Edward Best it does, you
okay.
know? And it's quite big, but it was too heavy,
yeah,
you know, when you stone it and everything.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
Like I couldn't keep that and dance. Mm. But that one I could, you know, the Louboutin one.
So that's the grand finale as such. That's like you pull that out,
yes,
at the end.
Yes, I
and
pull it out,
like,
and then I just put lipstick, but it's all to the beat, you know,
okay.
The burlesque song.
Okay, amazing. And you have been doing this in clubs, like performing in clubs for how many years now, would you say?
Well, I started out as a go-go dancer for Disco 2000, and then I became like kind of popular. So like I, with the kids, so I would start, it turned into hostessing and you would get a little bit more money. So it was better. But then I became like a model and then I was like more quiet and shy, you know, like that. So I didn't perform like back then. And then probably after David LaChapelle discovered me and, you know, had me go out naked all the time and everything, I became more confident because I would get like a really good reaction from the right people.
Yeah.
So then I think I was out one day and this gay rapper, Caswell, said, oh, I want to write a song for you. Like I'll help you. And I want it to be really good and blah, blah, blah. And like, so I started doing that. And then from doing this stuff with David, I kind of became internationally known. So like I was getting a lot of gigs, just, you know, sitting at a table or something and being like a spectacle more and taking pictures with people.
Yeah.
So then I started doing the songs, and then Castle did so many songs that it was an album.
Yeah.
And then I got like a manager and then, you know, started like touring with that and everything, and that seemed like better because I actually did something. It was like more exciting for me. And I used to just do naked things. I always liked that pinup kind of look, you know, because I was obsessed by Vargas and Marilyn Monroe and like all that kind of like vintagey stuff. So I always had sort of that look and everything. And then I got in trouble one time for being totally naked, which I used to always do in New York all the time with a club because they didn't have the liquor license. And around that time, Dita Von Teese was doing the pasties and things.
What's
and
pasty? Like the tassel thing? Yeah, like
you
nipples.
Cover the nipple and you kind of cover up just what you can't cover up, you know, like what you can't do legally, you know. So I saw her, so I said, oh, let me do that, then I could take my clothes off, because it was such a crowd pleaser to take off the clothes, because it symbolized freedom and you know, everything, and everyone loved it. So like it was like, oh, I gotta still take off my clothes. So like I started doing that, and then I got into doing the outfits and everything as well. And it was like fun, and I had like a lot of fun doing it. And now I'm just like doing a total burlesque number now.
Amazing. Okay, so where should we start? Dave LaChapelle, you mentioned him. Tell me about what he did in terms of how he changed your life, if he changed your life.
Well, he hired me for like a Visionaire Diamond thing the first time.
Yeah.
And he said that he was doing also like a, it was a fashion magazine, and he was doing like a plastic surgery story. So I saw him like that weekend, and he banged those two things out, the one with the sniffing diamonds and the one with the baby and all that. And then I just thought it was like a one-time thing, but he kept on like using me and using me and using me,
and he was went on, and was like, he was like doing really well at that point, right? Like
yes, he was actually, I knew who he was because there was a VH1 show and he won Photographer of the Year.
Okay, so then he kept using you, you said.
Yeah, he really liked me because I think like I was like really quiet, and I think when I did the thing with the diamonds, he had me positioned with like the diamond and this thing, and they took a break and I didn't move because he said, don't move, like that's perfect. But he just and he came back and I was still in that position, and he said, oh my god,
how long have you been there?
You know, like so he started, you know, using me like all the time. And it was like fascinated. I don't think he was using me like as like what it seemed like, you know, like for freak value or anything. I think he actually found me beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, because he was obsessed with like drawing these girls before he knew me, and they were usually like naked and in weird situations, you know, and like, and they look like me.
Yeah.
You know, with the cheekbones and the lips and the boobs and everything. So like he became like, he said, oh my god, like you look like these girls I was obsessed with.
Wow.
Drawing, so it was sort of like weird in that way.
Yeah, I read somewhere someone called you a walking sculpture. When did you first start like thinking and looking at your body like it could be art?
I didn't. I mean, I just like wanted to be like a pretty girl.
Yeah.
So around the time of the fashion stuff, like the art world also became like me, and they would like think I was a work of art and everything. And I mean, it's flattering and everything, but like I didn't really take it seriously.
Yeah.
You know, but people say it all the time. So like, I guess it's
yeah,
like a fact now.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me about the surgery, which you talk really openly about. When did you get your first bit of work done? Can you remember?
I had a nose job first, like hormones and a nose job, like when I was 15.
Yeah. And who was it that introduced you to the idea that you could, like, get that kind of thing?
I saw talk shows when I was a kid. And, like, I told my parents that I wanted to do that, like, when I was, like, 12. So as soon as, like, I got my hands on it, I just, you know, would do it, you know?
Yeah, and that was as in transitioning. Well, from that young, from 12, you were like, I don't want to be in a...
I talked about, you know, like, I... thought I was a girl when I was like little, you know, so like it, like, but I didn't really know what it was. It just felt different.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when there was like differences in school, like boys were there and the girls were there, I go, it would be like, uh-oh, like, you know, I'm in trouble, you know, help, did it to myself sort of, you know, like, but, you know, there was never any planning of changing anything. Like it was just sort of like, they're ready from the time I was like born that way.
Because I think, I mean, I don't know, but I can imagine it wasn't nearly as talked about, or there wasn't nearly as much awareness at all. So how did your parents take it when you said to them what you wanted to do?
Well, they were used to me
behaving
really feminine, so it didn't surprise them, you know? I hung out with like I was kind of like an outcast in like the town and stuff and everything. And this other girl was too, for being like sleeping with boys and being slutty, I guess, you know? And we became friends because we liked each other's style and stuff and everything. And she was prostituting. She was 15 as well. And she was prostituting and like working in a go-go place, but like underage. And I was making costumes for her, and then I would like buy lipsticks and things like that. And she told me that she thought that one of the girls was a transsexual. So,
and like, did you know what that was?
Yeah. She knew that I wanted to be like that, you know. Like so, there was no, and I would. She would let me, you know, borrow her clothes and things like that, and do makeup and would suggest stuff for each other. So it was like we had like a girly relationship, you know? So then so she the girls wanted to buy outfits that I made, because I made like these beaded costumes and they had rhinestones and things on them and stuff. And the one wanted to, you know, to buy them as well. So I asked her if she would trade hormones. And she said yes, as long as I didn't tell my parents. So then I started taking them one summer, and they worked really fast. Like, I started getting those knots in the boobs, you know, like when, in a month.
Wow.
And they were really sensitive. So that summer, I had boobs.
Wow.
So then when I went to back to school, I decided to just come as a girl, you know, like, because I was just dressing as a girl, like, all summer and got treated much better. So, and I figured I was getting harassed anyway, so I wouldn't care. So I didn't get bothered, but no one said anything. But they did take me to the guidance counselor and the guidance counselor so that I couldn't go like that. And they asked if I wanted to quit school, and because I was 16 at that time. And they, I said that I didn't, that I wanted to. So they gave me a private tutor, and they said that I had to go to, like, see a psychiatrist and stuff, and then I told him what I was doing, and then he prescribed hormones for me.
Oh, great. Okay, so he
so then supportive. I started getting them legally.
The psychiatrist?
Yes.
God, isn't it wonderful?
So then I had, like, you had to, then I met, like, a guy from hair, like, after, when I was going to hairdressing school, and he didn't know or anything, but when his father wanted to pay for my sex change surgery, you know? And when I went there, I already had 2 years of being
the
psychiatric care and the hormones. So I could get it right away. My mother wanted me to wait till I was 21, but then the father legally adopted me. And then I was able to just do it.
Okay.
Because she was schizophrenic, you know, so.
Yeah. So the father of the guy that you met, yes. He was your boyfriend?
Yes.
Yeah, so he helped your boyfriend? Like, did your boyfriend know what was going on?
He didn't know at first, and yeah. I think that's, like, I would go there, and they all thought I was a girl.
Yeah.
But the mother never found out. Like, they didn't tell her, but then I think that we got in a, like, he... I don't know, we would kiss, and then I would wear really tight jeans with, like, a girdle, kind of. Like, so, like, he didn't know, you know? Like, and I would say that it was a virgin, so he seemed to like me more. But then we would kind of do sexual things here and there. Like, he would want me to play with him, like, yeah. after a while, you know? And then one time we were alone, and he wanted to just see me naked and kiss, and just kiss it and not have sex. So then I had to tell him at that point, and he punched the wall. And then there was drama, and then I guess the father asked why I wasn't coming around, and then he told them. And then he said, oh, the poor girl, we have to help her and stuff, because they didn't have any idea. So then, and they knew that my mother was schizophrenic because I spent a lot of time over there.
Yeah.
So yeah. It kind of, he wanted to help me.
So are you grateful to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah.
Very.
After you went through the surgery, what happened with the boyfriend? Did you stay with him, or was he supportive?
Yeah, he loved it and
great
and everything. But like, he was in a car accident or something, and he had pain, so he was like got addicted to codeine, and he would make his father go for like prescriptions, and he would make me go after a while. It got really bad, and he had a bookstore from his aunt who passed away. He bought, so he worked in a bookstore, but we started like fighting, and he had like that addiction, and the father would feel sorry for me, and it got like strange because like I would be crying in the kitchen, and the father would come down, and then one time he was like holding me, and then he started kissing me. Oof. And then I started kissing him. Yeah. Then just for like the closeness of it, and then it became weird.
Yeah,
I never slept with him, but we sort of had this weird thing of. He would visit me when everyone was asleep and I was up.
So you spent a lot of time...
It was strange.
You spent a lot of time in that house because your mum, as you said, was schizophrenic, so she spent a lot of time away from home.
Well, at that, a little before my sex change, maybe, like a year before that, I started living with them.
Okay.
And my mother sold the house and moved to her hometown in Passaic and got, like, an apartment by herself and... Mm. She knew that I was with him.
Yeah. Did you like him?
I was seeing like two guys at the time, but he was like a little older and he had a car.
Yeah.
So I went with him.
Okay. Well, as a teenager, that's the absolute pragmatic decision.
Yeah. The other one better, but the car and everything was very attractive.
You've got to be practical about these things.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
I read a story, no, I wasn't reading, I saw an interview with you where you told this story about a nanny that you had and a Barbie doll. Would you tell me the story?
Well, when my mother would go away and stuff and everything, they started getting nannies to take care of us. And my father said that I like to play with Barbie dolls. So then she made like all these Barbie doll things to try to get my trust because she, you know,
yeah,
like that, and it was really sweet.
Yeah, yeah. So you did you love dressing them and
oh yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. Okay, so then you have your sex change. You moved to New York.
No, I stayed there for like a while.
In
but
New
then
Jersey.
He started getting abusive, and then I used to always go for hormone shots and things, and I met someone who was like in the middle, like not a, like kind of getting surgery, but not transsexual, but like not a guy either or something, but did shows or something. And he would always invite me to his shows. And then I finally told him that I couldn't go because my husband wouldn't let me out of the house and was like abusing me. And he said I could stay there. Like he said, oh, that's really terrible. And blah, 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 blah. And I didn't think of it that way. Mm. So like I started changing him in my mind, you know? Mm. And he was getting abusive and like the drugs and then the father. And it was just like kind of what I wanted to leave, you know? So I ran away and then went to his house. And then he turned out to be like a hustler. Mm. And I would have to get out of the house. So I would go to this coffee shop. And then I met like a Marine that was very handsome. And then he started doing like S&M things with
the Marine.
Okay. Like we would go on dates and it was great at first.
Yeah.
And then he started doing like these weird S&M things and I didn't like it, but I had to get out of the house and stuff. And I was doing nails then.
Okay.
But he said I could make a lot of money working in this dungeon.
Oh my goodness.
So I went there and then got a roommate with this girl that worked there. Who was sort of like a lesbian. Mm. And I think that she liked me, so it was weird a little bit. But I did make money from the S&M thing. So I left the Marine because, you know, I was just doing it for free with him.
So you were being like a dominatrix.
So I started being like a dominatrix. I didn't really like it, but I was able to, you know, get an apartment and all that. But I had like a depression too, like from it and stuff and everything. And then I got approached one day for my birthday, like on my birthday. And I met a nice, normal guy that was going to college or something. And then Michael Alec asked me if I would dance, you know, from the, you know, there and stuff and everything. And then I started like dancing because I already had like, that look, you know.
And all this time you were getting surgery the whole time, or how was it working then? Because obviously that cost
well
money,
I already right? had I got boobs later like when I was still with my husband, and so and then I would get lips done and things done, so like I was getting fillers, I guess, like from this plastic surgeon.
It
made a big difference.
You kind of had a vision in your head of what shape you wanted to be.
I like that hourglass kind of body.
Yeah. Was there a woman that you looked at, like a certain woman?
Probably Marilyn Monroe and Jane Mansfield and those kind of girls, you know?
Yeah. What does being a woman, like what would you say being a woman means to you? Like womanhood, talking about that.
Well, I think it's just more softer and gentler and using your mind more and just expressing yourself, you know? Mm. Like it's all like expression to make you feel good, you know? Mm. Like doing your nails and taking care of yourself, and that's like more of a feminine kind of a thing, and we look for a man for strength.
Do you not think that you're strong? Because I think you're strong as an ox.
My mind, yeah, but like not physically, no.
I see. Mm. Talking about femininity and the idea of femininity, yours is full femininity. You go to town. Why do you think that is? Is there a reason for your kind of outlook on femininity and on womanhood being so, I don't want to say exaggerated, but just like...
Well, I think that I always liked glamour and like fixing yourself up, you know, and being groomed, because my mother was schizophrenic, and when she was hospitalized and when she was sick, she wouldn't take care of herself. She wouldn't do her hair. She wouldn't wear makeup, and she would like act crazy. And then when she got better and she was on medication, she would like the lipstick would come. She would go to the beauty parlor. She would get her hair done. She would want to do all those things. Mm. So I kind of associate it with like healthy like a healthy mind.
Yeah.
And that it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Not a bad thing.
Wonderful. What's that like for you when you're out? I mean, obviously you go to clubs and people are expecting you and wanting to see you.
Well, after I got famous, it became more easier to work in the clubs because like I was occupied, the time would go by because people want pictures.
Yeah. You must spend a lot of time taking pictures of people.
Yeah.
But what about outside the clubs? Like you mentioned airports and stuff like that.
People recognize me on the street. I don't always wear makeup. Like I like wear just, you know, sunscreen and stuff. And I wear tight clothes and things, but people recognize me and still want pictures. So I make sure that I have sunglasses, you know, to take pictures with them. And I mean, it's really nice. I have like a great life. I mean, fortunately, fans and people are really polite and respectful to me, you know? Mm. So like it's great being me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, in that shop today, when I told them I wanted to buy you a gift in this vintage shop, people just lit up when I said your name. Is there a little community around here where you live where everyone knows you and you know them, like in the local?
Well, the nightclubs, I think.
Okay, yeah.
I think it's sort of like a family it becomes.
Mm. More. Yeah, it's funny with clubs, isn't it? It's kind of...
Yeah.
They're all like just lots
for
of little families.
For people that don't fit in, like the norm kind of thing, you know?
And do you find, like, what do your fans say to you in terms of what you've done for them?
They'll say that, like, you've done so much. A lot of people say, oh, you made me come out, you know, like, and stuff. And I think that they just admire the, to be yourself, like a symbol of, you know, that you could be yourself and be successful, you know, that it's not like it's a good thing, you know?
Mm. And as the years go by, are you finding that you are becoming like, there's a kind of legacy that you are leaving behind you? You know, sometimes life goes fast and then sometimes you're like, okay, people are talking about me like I've, you know, you're one of the first people to come out and be proud about being transgender and all that. Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
Legacy.
I mean, I don't take any of it seriously.
Yeah.
You know, but I realize it, you know, but I don't think about it really. Mm. You know, I'm more concerned with just going to work and doing things, you know?
Do you ever take a holiday?
No.
I didn't know. So. What do you think about the kind of state of play in America right now? In terms of having, I'm not going to get all political and deep, but having Donald Trump as president, what he represents for people like, on the margins.
Everyone hates him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't think that he's good. I mean, there's more and more shocking things that you hear just from Instagram, you know, like the, like one of them that was really sad was a trans girl, like that was a sex change in the army, and she had her surgery when she was in the army, and she had to fix complications, and the government was paying for the surgery, and then when Trump went on, he denied her, and she got fired too.
Wow.
For like the military thing, so really fucked up her life, and she's like a sweet, beautiful girl, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
So like, he's not good for, you know, alternative people, you know, good people. So like, I don't know. And they both have really bad hair. I mean, I can't get over
Donald like, needs Lorenzo in his life.
Yes, I think that the wife, I don't know her name, but
Melania, is it?
The wigs are really bad. Really, really, really bad. And you could tell that a gay guy does not do them. Or if he does, I don't know what's going on, but they're really bad. Like a gag when I see it.
Right, Amanda, you're going out tonight. You're going to do the show.
Yes.
Are you ready? Do you have to do more stuff?
Yeah, I have to figure out what I'm going to wear. I'm just doing a fitting for a fashion show.
Okay.
You know that I'm doing on Thursday, so I'm just kind of in my nightgown.
Yeah.
But ready, but I have to just figure out something to wear.
Okay.
After the fitting.
Okay. Know? Yeah. Well, I'm going to let you do that.
Okay.
Get out of your room. Okay. Get out of your room. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. It's hot right now.
It is hot, yeah. It was so interesting to get a glimpse into this bubble of Amanda Lepore's life that night in New York City. It was hard not to go up, actually, as she so casually laid out the events of her life and the trauma and the abuse that she suffered over the years. But for me, it was the end of her life that I found the most kind of heart-wrenching, seeing her as this confused kid clinging on to her mother's happiness. She's immensely brave, I think. And in my research about her, there's such an outpouring of love for her from transgender people because of her very existence, promoting this idea of being yourself and being what you need to be to get through life, you know? And I'm glad that she exists in this world because she is a kind of manifestation of what I was talking about at the start of just live and let live. Let people figure out who they are for themselves. Let them exist in the skin and the body they want to exist in. And fuck the haters. Okay, on next week's show, we talk about ambition. Specifically, 1 year of my life. I spent probably from when I left university, so from when I was about 20 to I was about 24, doing everything I could to get into the walls of Radio 1 and in front of the mic as a DJ. So those 4 years were hugely important to me. And I remember lots about those 4 years because so many big, seismic things happened to me in those 4 years. But 1 year in particular feels kind of zoomed in for me in terms of the memories that I have of it. And it's the year that I worked on the evening show on Radio 1 and the year that I became a DJ. The guest on my show next week is a man called Zane Lowe. He is a renowned DJ, broadcaster, and now got a huge, very flossy job at Apple Music, where he is global creative director for them. He is an old friend and an old colleague, and I was delighted to get him into a studio in London for an hour where we reminisced and talked about that one special year and talked about his life as a DJ and his kind of path when it comes to ambition over the years.
So this is another thing we'd spent ages crafting, is the opening,
the
intro, which was just a heartbeat.
Oh my God, how pretentious. It's so beautiful looking back on it.
It's brilliant. And then the show ended with the flatline, and Joe told me this morning that John Peel at the time was like, oh great that radio's dying just before my show.
Looking back, it's so disrespectful. Like, oh, we just killed the air.
I never thought about it from that perspective.
And we didn't, because we were so self-obsessed.
There you go, Zane Lowe. I can't wait for you to hear the full conversation next week on Finding Annie, and I'll see you then.